Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of Business Beyond Borders, where we have made it our mission to talk to global experts and professionals, entrepreneurs, CEOs, and founders from a variety of industries and fields, as we tackle the many aspects of scaling an international business. The goal here is to collect valuable insights and share in-depth knowledge so that you too can apply the winning techniques and strategies to go global and take your business to the world.
Hi there, I'm Cynthia Dearen, and welcome to Business Beyond Borders, where I unlock the secrets of international business success. Today, I'm chatting to someone who I've been hoping to have on the show for quite a while, and that's Tom Griffith, co-founder of Australian company Emma & Tom, which makes juice and a whole bunch of other drinks. The company's turned into something of an international sensation, and today we're going to find out how that happened. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you, nice to be with you.
Now, I am very excited to hear the Emma and Tom story, but before we get there, given what's going on in the world at the moment, how are you doing? How's COVID-19 affecting the business?
We're only down about 85%, which is better than, 100. So, which has caused challenges because it means we haven't been able to ice the whole thing down completely, because there's the 5,000 plus cafes that have closed.
Mm.
But then you've got Coles, Woolworths and, say, Caltex, and a bit of the food service that's still going. So we've gone down to a skeleton. JobKeeper's been a huge saviour. Thank you, Josh and Scott. Huge saviour. We've done everything we could with things like people like landlords. Corporate landlords, to their credit, have been fantastic. One of our landlords is a super fund owned by a family. And they've been, I think, really good and said, let's just knock it down a bit, but give us a bit of income as well. So we thought that was reasonable. So we've juggled staff and JobKeeper and everything else. I mean, Emma and I aren't 20 years old. We've been through the GFC and the tech wreck, and I was in London doing a startup when 9/11 happened. So you sort of get used to it and you sort of play the cards you dealt.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I would have, just if you'd asked me as a guest, I probably would have thought that you might have been like a supermarket brand that's gone through the roof and everybody's hoarding, everything they can get their hands on. But is the drop-off you've seen a function of the distribution channels where your stuff is usually being sold?
Yeah, well, firstly, China fell through the whole, into a heap as of December 31. That just stopped. And then we always thought we were quite a diversified risk base because of our 40-odd vans that service 3,000 plus cafes every week. And we weren't reliant upon Coles and Woolworths, where right now, of course, the people who are reliant on Coles and Woolworths are doing relatively better. Problem with being fully reliant on Coles and Woolworths, and this doesn't apply to us, it applies to anyone, you do run the risk if you get a new buyer, and just because it's a day of the week that ends in Y, they can kick you out.
Yeah.
If that happens to you, you lose half your business. So our diversified risk base has come a cropper given what's happened with cafes.
And do you think that will change what you do going forward? I mean, does that make you think that maybe you want to change the strategy long term, or do you see this pandemic as just something that's going to happen for a period of time this year and then we'll go back to business as usual?
No, we've been doing more in Coles and Woolworths. We've always grew up as being an impulse brand, and the business evolved because we started doing our own distribution. Of course, once you start driving a van, you start wearing a distribution cap as well as a brand owner cap, and you go, well, hang on, if you're going to stop the van, let's sell them some more things. So you start doing bars and milk and sparkling and kombucha and kefir water, and we've now got 60 or 70 different products. But we are doing more, particularly in these newer, smaller format Coles and Woolworths, the Woolworths Metro and the Coles Local. Because let's be honest, if you're going to try and sell someone a pre-made meal, and normally those are quite healthy and these days delicious, it's very hard to look him in the eye and say, that's going to go really well with a sugar-filled soft drink. So our kefir waters, our juices are going really well in those particular locations, and they're growing rapidly. So really, we're evolving out of our reliance upon cafes and delis anyhow. Mm-hmm. And that was done to build the brand, because obviously if you go to your favorite cafe and buy a sandwich and the person on the counter says, look, try this Emma & Tom's kefir water, it's fantastic, So you try it, you like it, you haven't been advertised at, you've discovered it yourself, you like it, and you tell your friends. And that's been how we've tried to build the brand over, you know, 15 plus years. I think it's worked, but now we're looking at capitalizing upon that, of course.
Yeah. So slightly different strategy for a slightly different time.
Yeah. Yeah. And you've got to, you know, once again, when you grow quickly, you've got to review your strategy every couple of months, because otherwise you get away with things.
Absolutely. So I am fascinated to hear how you wound up running a juice and other kind of drinks company. What's the Emma and Tom story?
Well, as they say, I couldn't dance and couldn't sing. So as they say, I was working as a CFO in London, and I've been doing a lot of work with Pernod Ricard, the French drinks conglomerate. I'd done a startup, and then the startup failed, and we sold what we had to Bernie Eccleston's media unit, and I went skiing, and I was hopping in the gondola every morning drinking these green smoothies. And that was sort of the penny drops. And I had sort of branded drinks in one frame and startup. And I knew, I'd known Emma for my whole life, really. And her background was much better than mine at doing this. She had been Uncle Ben's, the Mars pet food business, for 5 years. I'd lived in France for a while. And she'd been studying in France, doing an MBA at INSEAD. And we sort of stayed together, you know, living parallel lives. So I put it to her that we should try and do an Australian version of these super premium fruit juices. And she agreed, and we did. And that was in 2003. We started from scratch. So like, we had no knowledge of the entire industry between us, none. So we had to work out, you know, who makes bottles and who fills bottles and who makes labels and what's the brand called. And we decided to call it Emma and Tom's to capitalize on. It was just us against large multinationals. And a year after we started working on it, we launched 4 bottles of juice.
And what happened next?
We made 8,000 bottles and didn't have any customers.
So how did you deal with that?
Well, see, a minimum run's about 1,000 litres. They're not going to turn a line on, even the smallest line, for less than that.
Yes.
So 1,000 litres gives you, call it 2,000 bottles. There's your plus four flavours is 8,000 bottles. Then we made 8,000 bottles the following Monday and 8,000 bottles the one after that. So we're running around Melbourne and Sydney with our hit list. And we had a distributor who had a call centre, an outward bound. So we were getting as many customers as we could, but we were sort of stockpiling juice every week as well. And in those days, they only had 21 days life on it because it was pretty rudimentary. So we ended up sponsoring around the bay in a day, and 12,000 cyclists got a bottle of juice in their lunch bag. And that was sort of the first marketing initiative. So we've always tried to, you know, turn negatives into positives and sort of capitalize on problems. And that was our first issue.
What did you learn from that experience of having 8,000 bottles of juice and nowhere to sell them?
Well, we've learned about stock management. And, you know, once again, thanks to our new ERP system, we can now manage stock a lot better than we used to be able to doing on a spreadsheet. But it just shows you, I mean, it's very easy in any business to lose money, you know.
Yeah.
8,000 bottles cost you probably $10,000. So back in those days, that was a big number.
Yeah.
You know, now we sell a lot more than that per week, obviously. But nowadays, we're even more careful because with problems becomes larger numbers. So it's about just being controlled and organized.
So this was around 2004. The company's been going for around 16 years. At what point did you decide that you'd start selling overseas? And I mean, what was the catalyst to do that? Was this something opportunistic, or had international expansion always been something you thought you'd do from early on?
The sound advice from every single person you'd ever talk to who's more experienced than you are is, you're an Australian business. You've got to be a success in Australia. Don't hinge yourself on nailing China and that'll be the end of the whole problem. Yeah, because once again, China requires us to be a valid brand in Australia anyhow. They want to see, you know, a proper living, operating business in Australia that gives their Chinese sales credibility, for example, using China. We went to Gulf Food.
Yep.
And met a very nice man called Murad, and he had a distribution business he was just starting, and they're a family business in Jordan. So we actually launched in Jordan.
Wow, that's pretty unusual.
Yeah, well, because it was based upon relationships, you see. Yeah. And Emma and I only had dinner with Murad in Melbourne last year. He's now doing Dubai as well. And then we came across a business that was also starting up in Shanghai and Beijing. and they wanted to use us as a door opener and a brand to roll out. So that brought about China and Hong Kong. And then similar relationships have established in Singapore and Malaysia. So for us, it's about the relationship.
And so when you're going about working out where you're going to sell to, is it all about relationships and, you know, coming across the right distributor, or are there other things that you take into account? I mean, can you just walk me through your thought process a bit when you're choosing a new market to go to?
We've never thrown any money at it. So we haven't, you know, we believe to be a success, you've got to be on the ground like we are in Australia, first thing. So secondly, we then knock our margin down as far as we can bear to give the new appointed agent or distributor or importer more margin than they might otherwise have, to allow them to use sample stock and some marketing and, you know, fund the brand launch in a shared fashion in that country. And then we, you know, it's about communication. We work very closely. I mean, you know, we've been told back in February that, you know, hotel occupancy in Shanghai was down at between 4% and 8%. Now, you know, we were aware of that then. I mean, so we could sort of see it coming a bit in Australia. They are coming back, as you would have seen probably in the paper a few weeks ago. The head of Compass was announcing that his customers are probably 95% back in China. So it's a good barometer at the same time. China isn't the silver bullet, of course. I mean, it's as hard to launch there in a supermarket as it is in Australia. And it's competitive. And it's more global than Australia. So, you know, none of these things are easy and shouldn't be underestimated.
Are there some countries that you found easier to work in than others?
Hong Kong has been going gangbusters. That's been very strong for us. We can do better in China, but once again, it's competitive. And we've actually had to tailor our products. We've now launched in the last 6 months four of our juices in a long life glass bottle, which will give the distributor in China, obviously, a lot more headroom. And it gives the customers more comfort. And even though it's longer life and a hot filled product, some people prefer glass. I don't buy into the environmental argument as much as others do, because it's heavier to transport and there's other factors involved. But in some minds, people think glass is more premium.
Yes.
So then we do a lot of food service in China, you know, hotels and things. And the glass will give us more opportunity there. So you've got to obviously, once again, tweak your model to fit the market.
So tell me about some of the things you've found most challenging about selling internationally.
Well, I mean, it's good for cash flow, because we get, you know, FOB, free on board. So, which means for those who don't export, you get paid before the stock leaves the country. So that helps. And that also allows you to price it more keenly for the market too, obviously. For us, it's been shelf life. And I suppose supporting the distributor as much as possible, because of course distributors have a tough life. They can put a lot of work in and then lose the account. So we try to work with them to make it very much a dual process.
And culturally, are there things that you found surprising, different, hard to work with as you've worked with distributors from around the world?
Look, I'm not that Asian centric. Emma and her husband are much more so. My experience is sort of European, which doesn't help our business at all. Emma and Michael, Emma's husband, had done a lot of work in China before our business. So they were much, much more fluent with how to go about business in China, for example. And a couple of our distributors in the other Asian countries are actually expat Australians. And that's just a coincidence, but that's helped a lot too.
Yeah. Now, tell me, you know, there are lots of twists and turns in business and, you know, highs and lows. If you had to pick a proudest moment with Emma and Tom, what would it be, do you think?
Emma and I don't dwell on it an awful lot at all, I can tell you. We sort of sit at work and chuck rocks at each other and just get on with it. I've been working remotely for the last month for obvious reasons, and I've been out of Melbourne, and there's a couple of customers down where I've been staying who have the big two-door Emma and Tom's fridges, which are fantastic. I mean, that's probably the proudest thing, because what that provides the consumer is the well-being, natural, no added sugar alternative to the multinational offerings that are the polar opposite. So we've now got to the point where we are offering a range of drinks as broad as you would get from one of the, once again, these multinational businesses, but they're not full of sugar. They're natural, they're minerally processed, they're made in Australia.
Mm.
We're getting more functional, probably doing kefir water and things. And kefir water we're loving on the back of the fermented craze with kombucha. Just so you understand, when kombucha ferments, it makes citric acid, which is why it's quite vinegary and a bit tart, bitter, where kefir water makes lactic acid. So it's not nearly as harsh on the palate, but you're still getting your 1 billion plus bacteria per bottle. So I think probably the fact that we are providing the impulse healthy drinks and snacks that people can now, and also now we're in 8,000 plus locations in Australia, you can get it.
Yeah,
it's available. You know, you'd walk past an Emma Tom's product probably in an ordinary course of life once a day. And now our job is to have people understand that they can feel good about themselves for buying it. You know, I'm a good dad, I buy it for my daughters. That's the emotion thing, as you know.
And so when you think about that, I mean, you've come a really long way in the last 14 years. Where to from here for Emma and Tom, the brand? What do you foresee? What have you got planned?
There's still a long, long list of new products we'd like to develop. You know, the brand stretch, we've proven the brand stretch. We proved it early on with the Life Bars being dried fruit and raw nuts. And they went into Woolworths Health Food very soon after we launched them, because Woolworths actually saw them in cafes and approached us. So we know the brand stretches, as long as it sort of ticks the right boxes. And we did a visual positioning statement, which is like 9 photographs and words that summarize the brand early on. And as long as things fit into that sort of matrix, they get approved. And they've got to taste fantastic. They've got to be no added sugar, and they've got to be minimally processed. But after all that, we have license to launch a whole variety of new things. We've focused on the route trade and impulse, and we've of course can then now diversify and broaden that ranging into take-home packs at the supermarkets. So rather than being in the impulse food fridges, we can put, you know, 1 liter, 2 liter containers now in the take-home areas. So there's a lot of upside there and a lot of sales revenue there to be taken.
And more international markets on the cards, you know, US, UK. Yep.
US is a hard one. We're still looking at Asia, obviously, because it's next door, but definitely with an eye on Europe and the US, yes.
Now, I know that you love partnerships, so I'm keen to get your thoughts on that. You've obviously had a really long-running partnership with Emma. What's the secret? I mean, how do you make a good partnership work?
Well, firstly, we're good friends. We're not best friends. We do what's best for the business, for the brand, for the consumer, not what's best for Tom or Emma. And that helps an awful lot. Emma would put it down to 3 factors that we have, I suppose: trust, respect, and a shared vision. So that helps enormously. So we're both on the same page. And uniquely in our business, we both have a very similar palate, and that helps too, actually. You know, Emma's got a lot of experience in this type of industry, which has helped the business enormously. I suppose her glass is probably half empty. She'd be the first to admit that, and mine's half full. So that sort of helps too. We have a different lens on the business. Yeah. Trust, respect, and a shared vision. Probably the secret to most relationships, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's probably right.
And probably compromise too.
Yep, picking one's battles.
Yep.
Now, I know Tom and Emma is keeping you, I should say Emma and Tom, is keeping you very busy, but you've also got a new business in the works. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I always said that I'd do less at Emma and Tom's when we found people who are better qualified to do my job, and we have. So I was having lunch with the very nice guy who runs Daryl Lee, and I sort of explained how I did a bit of our new product development. I did some marketing, I did some CFO work. And now we have a full-time NPD person, a full-time marketing person, and a full-time CFO. To which he replied, well, no wonder you're busy. So now we've got those key roles in place, and they're gun people. I'm doing a bit less than Emma and Tom's, and I've been working with some friends of mine to produce the first plastic palette. So everyone knows about CHEP and Loscombe, who have the main pooled pallet businesses, but they're wooden pallets. You can't sterilize wood, and you can't use wood for export because it can't be sterilized. The export trade currently uses 3 billion one-way pallets per year. And pallet production accounts for 40% of deforestation annually as well. So we're working on producing the first plastic pallet, which is sterilizable. It's lighter and stronger than wood. It's repairable. And at the end of life, it's rebatable. We'll give you a rebate to give it back to us. So it's a circular recycling system. We want it back because we actually know where the plastics come from. It's not full of used nappies and things. It's good plastic. So that's a bit of a game changer. And obviously, more and more, we had things like recyclable and repairable as our sort of front running points. And now point nine of the pack on page three used to be sterilizable. And now with the recent issues in the world, sterilizable becomes one of the main factors. So with the increasing food and pharmaceutical trade, sterilizable is obviously highly important these days. So these pallets are very easily sterilized as well. So that's sort of pretty exciting. And I've been doing a bit of that now for on the side for about 3 or 4 years. And we've just got some samples out to be tested. And the results are coming back very, very strongly. And obviously, it's a huge market. I mean, I think CHEP alone buys, this is from the annual report, 75 million new pallets a year in the US alone. So it's a massive business. I know pallets aren't very sexy, but as Emma always says, there's money in muck, you know, in the areas that people don't focus on. And everyone uses pallets, of course. So even for these new dark warehouses that all of the big, you know, Amazons and Costcos are building, the dark warehouse, which is not, of course, manned, has no staff. Of course, if there's all these wooden pallets on racks and the forks come along to pick them and the tings hit wood, because wood, of course, expands and contracts, they need to be exact. And of course, plastic, you can be built to an exact specification. So there's a lot of applications for these. So that's a little side business. And obviously people ask me about the plastic that Emma and Tom's packs their juices in. Well, it can now go into a circular recycling system.
It's fantastic. I love it. Tom, have you got any final thoughts for business owners or CEOs who are listening to this episode of the podcast and wondering about whether they should be expanding internationally?
Look, one thing we didn't do early on was take advice from people. It wasn't through arrogance or anything. We were just busy. We had our little strategy and we were going about it. Also, when we first launched, Emma had a son and I and my partner had two daughters. So we were doubly busy. And we weren't taking advice and we were missing a lot of stuff. In fact, we were churning customers at about 30% per annum, which was very costly. We finally put together an advisory board and we took a lot of advice. We now seek advice daily and we almost, a bit like you do, when we go and see a person for advice, we then try and get a referral for someone else we can go and talk to, because people are very generous with their time and we similarly try and be generous with our time now with other people. So I think take advice and look at your strategy, continuously challenge yourself, because you know things move and change an awful lot and everyone's in their bubble and you can't help that. But if you get somebody outside the bubble in a helicopter at 30,000 feet looking down on things, it does help enormously.
I think that is an awesome piece of advice. It has been an absolute treat talking to you today. Thank you for coming on the show.
Pleasure. Nice to be involved. Thank you very much.
Hi, everyone. This is Maher again. And just a few things before you head off. Firstly, if you feel you have gained valuable insights from the show, make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss another episode. More importantly, don't forget to tell your fellow entrepreneur and business leader friends that this is the best podcast to tune into if they're looking to take on the world with their products and services. Also, if you are loving the podcast, please take the time to rate and review, as it's one of the best ways for us to get loads of free value into the hands of other entrepreneurs. And lastly, make sure to visit DearinAssociates.com. That's DEARIN Associates.com. Where we have plenty of free resources and tools for you to get clarity and build momentum with your international venture. If you go there, you'll find the Blueprint to International Success, ebooks, our latest blog posts, and more. So be sure to check it out. And until next time, this is me encouraging you to expand your vision and wishing you all the best as you continue your global journey.